It's great to see you again. Did you have any questions left over from last week? We kind of focused on chapter 16 where Peter made this amazing confession. You are the anointed leader of humanity, the Messiah, the Christ, and that changes everything. All good. That's kind of a hinge point in the Gospel of Mark, and it is in the Gospel of Matthew as well. So once people have begun to recognize Jesus as the Christ, to get this revelation from heaven about who he is, the next four chapters, the ones we're studying tonight and next week, are all about what kind of kingdom Jesus intends to run. So chapter 17, we're going to see heaven confirming Peter's statement. This really was a revelation Peter got from heaven. And in the Transfiguration, heaven confirms that statement, and Jesus again explains that it's not just like drift on in and everybody be happy to have him come. There are people who want to assassinate him. And so he explains that. Then in chapter 18, we get into Jesus' teaching about what kind of kingdom he wants us to experience. Now, we've seen that all the way through Matthew. Pretty much the whole Sermon on the Mount was about that. And the parables of the kingdom were telling us about how life would be like under his kingship. And chapter 18 is incredibly practical, and 19 and 20 as well. So if you're one of those people who wants to see how this works in practice, you're going to actually love stuff like how to sort out relationships when there are struggles. And there's some other things we'll cover after the break as well. So that's kind of where we're going this evening and next week. We'll start with the Transfiguration. Do you want to start reading? On page 111, you've got my translation of the first eight verses of Matthew 17. I'll pop the other one up on screen so you can compare it. The whole point of using my own translation is just simply it's a fresh way of hearing these words, because you've heard them the same way all your life growing up the way I did, that you can lose some of their impact. So the first eight verses.
So Matthew 17, 1 to 8, 6 days later, Jesus takes Peter and James and John, his brother. He leads them up a high mountain on their own. He was visibly transformed before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothing became as bright as sunlight. And look, they saw Moses and Elijah in dialogue with him. Peter responded to Jesus, "Lord, it's so good for us to be here. If you like, I will set up three shelters here, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, look, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and take note, a voice spoke from the cloud, "This is my son, the one I love, the one I'm pleased with. Listen to him." Hearing it, his followers fell on their faces, utterly terrified. Jesus came over to them, reached out to them and said, "Stand up, don't be afraid." When they looked up, they saw no one else, just Jesus.
Brilliant. Now, this is a fairly unusual story, to see Jesus glowing in some kind of heavenly majestic majesty is an unusual experience. Why does God give this experience to the three? I think heaven is confirming what Peter just told us. Peter said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And what does God say in verse 5? "This is my son." Oh, same thing. So when Jesus said, "You didn't get this because I told you, I explained it to you, you didn't get it because you figured it out for yourself, you got this revelation from my Father," here it is again. The Father is giving the revelation, not just to Peter, but to make sure that James is confirming the message that Peter has received and announced. Now, we have, in the Gospel of Matthew, we have not heard a voice from God since the very beginning. There was an event right at the start of Jesus' ministry where there was a voice from heaven. Do you remember that? What that event was? And do you remember what the voice said? So that was the message in the beginning. That was the revelation God gave to Peter in the previous chapter. Seems like God's going to get one message for humanity, and that message is Jesus. I want to suggest to you that we only have one message, and that message is a person. The person of Jesus as the heaven-anointed ruler for the world, the Christ, the Messiah, the Son who has the authority on earth of the heavenly sovereign, his Father who reigns forever as he receives that authority from the Father. That's how the Gospel of Matthew ends, isn't it? You know the very like closing verses of Matthew's Gospel? Jesus is back from the dead and he says, all authority has been given to me. So the Father is making that proclamation again, because God has one message for humanity. The message is, this is my Son. This is the one to whom I have given the throne, to whom I have given the heavenly kingship, the one who reigns on behalf of heaven. And so God's command for humanity is, listen to him. Take notice of him. Follow him. That's the gospel. That's the good news. The good news is that God has put Jesus in charge of the world. There's no better news ever. That is the gospel. That is what Paul in Romans 1 calls God's gospel, the gospel that God proclaims. God's got this one message for humanity, and we are joining God in making that proclamation, and God is calling humanity to listen to him, and we are calling on people to recognize God, but we're trusting that God gives the revelation so that people will be able to respond and to do that. So what we're seeing here is the gospel. I don't know if you recognize this as being the gospel, but God has this one message. Thoughts about the gospel? Is that all right? Yeah. So a couple of other interesting things that are happening here. There is Moses and Elijah. Interesting pair of characters.
Can I ask a question? How did they know it was Moses and Elijah?
How did they know it was Moses and Elijah? How did they know? Can anyone suggest to Keith how they might have known?
Unless somebody told them, because they've never seen Moses.
That's correct. They'd never seen him.
Somebody must have told them.
Yep. Or maybe they heard the conversation start. Moses, Elijah, Jesus. You know, I don't know how they knew. But in conversation, it's clear who Jesus is talking to. I think it's part of the conversation that they realize it.
So all that the Holy Spirit could have just given them understanding what they mean in their spirit?
That's possible too, that they just realize what is going on from the content of what's being talked about here. Now, this has been an amazing conversation to listen to. For me personally, wherever I find a New Testament verse that's quoting or alluding to an Old Testament verse, for me, this really helps me to put the whole story together. And I would love to know what was happening in this dialogue that was happening between Jesus and Moses and Elijah. But I think they're the two key characters who represented the whole of the Old Testament narrative. The first five books of the Old Testament, what we call the Torah, or the Pentateuch, sometimes called the Law, the Jewish people referred to them as the books of Moses, right? Because Moses goes up Mount Sinai and gets the message from God. So therefore, Moses is a prophet, because a prophet is someone who hears from God and then declares the message to the people. So Moses is the prophet who receives the original founding covenant message from God that establishes Israel as a nation under divine kingship. He's the founding prophet of Israel. And then as the kingdom split, and there's some to the north that are not following God much at all, and there's Judah to the south with Jerusalem, and some of the kings are following, some are not, God sends Elijah to the northern kingdom. And Elijah's message is essentially to bring these northern tribes back under God's kingship, because they've strayed. And in Elijah's time, the king is Ahab, and he's got this foreign wife who worships the Baals and other gods. And Elijah does this huge confrontation on Mount Carmel. Remember that? There's been no rain. The whole nation is being brought to its knees, because they are a farming community. And it's just falling apart. And they pray, and God answers with fire. And the people of Israel say, Yahweh, he is God. the Lord, he is God. So they recognize who is that. They get this revelation of who God is. Most of the prophets have founded the kingdom, and Elijah is the prophet who founds the whole prophetic ministry that's calling people back to the covenant relationship with God. That's the significance of Elijah, one of the former prophets, foundational in that sense of calling people back to the covenant. And then after him, there's lots of other prophets who come and do a similar kind of a job. So in Hebrew thinking then, the law and the prophets is how they describe the whole of the Old Testament. That's what they call the Old Testament. So I think these two guys are representing the law, Moses, and the prophets, Elijah. So the whole story of God is now coming together in dialogue with Jesus. It's finding its fulfillment in Jesus. Jesus is the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. We've been seeing this again and again in Matthew, haven't we? And that's why I think Jesus is seen to be in dialogue with these guys, because all of Israel's story is now coming together in the one who is now the prophetic voice from heaven, who is calling Israel back to God again. But actually not just Israel, but all the nations will also be brought under God's kingship in a way that Israel itself had never experienced in the Old Testament. That was always the goal of Israel, to bring the nations back under God's blessing and to be a light to the nations. And so the blessing of God could go out to that. That was Israel's calling, but they hadn't managed to fulfill that calling yet. And all of that calling is being fulfilled in Jesus. The law and the prophets are in dialogue with him, and God's entire purposes are coming together in the Messiah. I think that's why it's Moses and Elijah. Does that make sense? Beautiful. For the disciples, this is a terrifying experience, and they don't know what to say. Peter has to say something. Some of you are okay with silence, others are not. If there isn't somebody talking, then Peter feels like he's got to chip in and says, this is the most amazing experience. I think we should build three booths here and hang around and just celebrate this experience. And God's message is, forget about the other two. This is my son. You listen to him. They fall down on the ground, terrified. That tends to happen when God speaks. I don't know if you remember what happened when God spoke at Mount Sinai. People utterly terrified, freaking out. They go to Moses and they say to him, this is too much. We can't have God speaking to us. We'll die. How about you go speak to God and then come back and tell us what God wants? We don't want God speaking to us. Now, I don't know if God felt like that was a bit of an insult, but he capitulated to what the people asked for. I love the way that God is so gentle. Instead of forcing himself on them, going, you guys need to listen to what I've got to say, God says, all right. And from that moment, throughout the Old Testament, God spoke to them through Moses and the prophets instead of directly. And now God has come to speak to us through his son. That's how the New Testament puts this all together for us. The book of Hebrews is written to Hebrew people who are very familiar with the Old Testament story. And it begins like this. In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets, prophets like Moses and Elijah, many times in various days. But in these last days, he's spoken to us by his son. So what God wants to say to us now has come to us in the person of Jesus, whom he has appointed as the heir of all things, because he's the anointed ruler, the one God has chosen, so that all things come together in the Messiah, through whom he made the entire universe. And the Son is the radiance of God's glory. That's what they saw in the Transfiguration. For just a moment, they saw the majesty that Jesus was carrying. Jesus didn't dress like Caesar. He didn't have the external majesty of Herod. But in this moment, they saw the radiance of the divine glory that was his character. The exact representation of God's being, sustaining everything as the powerful word of God arrives on earth, transforms everything through him. That's what the transfiguration was all about. So the disciples are face down on the ground, and Jesus comes over and lifts them up. He says, get up, don't be afraid. They looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. So I've still got God's message in the person of Jesus. And I've heard the voice saying, listen to him. And the first instruction Jesus gives them is this: don't tell anyone. Why? Why are they not to tell?
Well, it puts them on the limb, doesn't it? I mean, even now, if you're mixing with a country where there's division and you're mixing with that leader,
yep,
there's a good chance that you might end up not being alive. Right?
Spot on. It's too dangerous. Don't tell anyone until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. What's about to happen is that he is about to be killed because he is God's anointed. And those who want power want him dead. So it's not safe for Jesus, and it certainly isn't safe for them, to be saying, actually, Herod doesn't run the world, Jesus does. That would not be a safe message. So they keep this to themselves until God has given him the kingship by raising him from the dead after the rulers of this world kill him. And then the disciples ask this question. So why do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? Now, in the final chapter of our Old Testament, there's a reference to Elijah. I will send the prophet Elijah to you. Right? This is the last of the minor prophets at the end of the Old Testament. And God says, we haven't got this whole thing sorted out yet, but I will send Elijah to you before the great and dreadful day of the Lord comes. He will turn the hearts of the parents towards their children so that the division within households ceases, and the hearts of the children towards their parents. So there's a sense of like reconciling and unity in the nation. And if they don't respond, then I will strike the land with total destruction. Now, that's not a very nice way to end the Old Testament. If the Messiah, Jesus, the anointed ruler, was bringing God's reign to the earth, but before this great day of the Lord comes, Elijah had to come and turn the children towards their parents towards their children. Had that happened? That's the disciples' question. And Jesus' answer to that question is, yeah, he did. He already came. Verse 11. Sure, Elijah comes to restore everything. That was his goal. So did Elijah come and manage to make things safe for Jesus? So there's this unity in the nation. Everyone's willing to follow God's anointed and the whole nation will be restored. Everything will be nice and smooth now. Is that how it worked? No, it's not. The Elijah is the most recent prophet to have come. Jesus kind of, Matthew rather, gives it away as to who Jesus is talking about. So John the Baptist is the guy who came with the spiritual prophetic authority of an Elijah. And his calling from heaven was to turn the hearts of the people towards God, to correct them. And certainly we heard his voice doing that in the chapter about Jesus' baptism. But what happened? He didn't get to finish the job, did he? Remember what happened? Herod locked him up. And then what happened in the end? He finished off without a head. His last prophetic announcement was this head revealing the power of death over Herod's reign. So he's certainly come, he's certainly made the prophetic statement, but he hasn't made it safe for Jesus. So if he hasn't had a chance to complete that task, then the Son of Man is going to have a very similar experience to what the new Elijah did. They're going to kill Jesus as well. And that's why they aren't to say anything until Jesus returns from the dead. Any questions on the whole block? Thoughts?
So just like Elijah was called to bring the people back to God,
yes,
trade and worshipping Baals and that, John the Baptist, the same thing. That's
yeah.
why
yeah.
in the spirit of Elijah.
Yes. Gotcha. Yeah, and Elijah.
I never understood that.
Elijah never finished the job. And you know what? John the Baptist didn't finish the job either.
But it's the same calling.
Same calling.
Come back to God.
That's it. Yeah. That's it, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Come back under God's management, under God's authority, under God's ruler.
A lot of people take it as the fact that he was actually in the form of John the Baptist, which isn't so.
No. John the Baptist wasn't actually alive. Because Elijah didn't actually die. He was taken up in a whirlwind. But it's not like physically Elijah had come back and John the Baptist wasn't. No, it's not that kind of identity. It's the prophetic calling Malachi was talking about. It's the prophetic calling that Jesus recognized. So if you can see it, he is the Elijah prophet.
Yeah.
He came to fulfill that task. It still got cut off before his time. Because that's the nature of evil. That's the nature of sin. That's what evil rule does. So the Son of Man will have to suffer that as well. Let's go on to talk about trusting his leadership then. Lynn, it must be your turn to read verses 14 to 20.
Okay. As they rejoined the crowd, a man came up and fell to his knees before him, saying, "Lord, please help my son. He has fits and suffers injuries, as he often falls into the fire and often into the water. I brought him to your followers, but they couldn't heal him." Jesus replied, "O faithless and misguided generation, how long will I be with you? How long can I put up with you? Bring him here to me." Jesus rebuked it, the demon left him, and the child was healed from that moment. Jesus' disciples approached him privately and asked, "How come we couldn't cast it out?" He says to them, "Because of your small-scale faith. I tell you the truth, if you were to have faith the size of a mustard seed, you will tell this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you."
I don't know if any of you can relate to these experiences. I don't know if you've prayed for people and seen God heal. It's just phenomenal when God does this stuff. It's amazing stuff. I don't know if you've prayed for people and they didn't actually get healed in that moment. And you're left wondering, what's wrong? Is it something wrong with my faith? And Jesus is not saying you have to have a monster-sized faith to get a healing. This is just a simple grain of mustard seed. Would do, little tiny herb seed. So it's not about how much faith you can muster up. It's not about how confident you feel. Faith ultimately rests in who is in charge. It's a trust, it's a reliance on the character of God. And whatever God says is what we trust. So my trust is not in how much faith I've got. My trust is in what God says. Mountains were a symbol of stuff that doesn't change. In the centuries before the time of Jesus, Jerusalem had been overrun so many times. From the time when the Babylonians came in and wiped it out, and then it became Persian territory, and then you've got the whole Maccabean period where they're fighting against Antiochus Epiphanes IV, and then you've got the Romans invading 63 years BC, and there's just been all this turmoil. And what tends to happen when there's a war on is that the place gets flattened, gets demolished, gets destroyed, and then it has to get built again. So over the centuries, the only bit that stays the same is the mountains. When they come back from Babylon, and some of the Psalms are saying, the hills around Jerusalem are still here. Right? The mountains stay. They don't change shape. They're the bit that remains while human powers and kingdoms come and go and change the topography and wreck the buildings. The walls can shift over time, but the mountains stay the same. And so when Jesus says you can say to this mountain, "Move," and it will do it, that's the bit that's impossible from a human point of view. Human kingdoms can't shift the mountains. Now, I don't know exactly where they were at this stage. Last we heard, they were somewhere near Caesarea Philippi, which is way north of Galilee. And if Jesus took them up a high mountain to see his transfiguration, there is one mountain in this vicinity that would qualify. Mount Hermon, 9,000 feet, snow covered. How much faith do you need to move a 9,000 foot mountain, if that's what Jesus is pointing to, if that's the location that they're in? I mean, that's just like before you could even begin to move the mountain, it's going to totally crush you if you try. Just no way that you can do that. But Jesus says, if you have this trust in who God is, then nothing will be impossible for you. Please note that the you is a plural. Like, this is not just me as an individual deciding I'll have a nice new BMW now. This is what we together as the people of God discern that God has said, because our faith is always in what God said, not in what we dream up. So it's what we discern that God has said. And if God has said, this is going to change, the topography of the earth is going to change, then God is terraforming the earth. He's totally transforming it, and nothing can stand against that, and we will see it change. So the disciples have been struggling to get rid of a demon, and they weren't able to cast it out. And Jesus is saying, there's absolutely nothing, not even a 9,000-foot mountain, that can stay if God has decreed that it will fall. So demonic powers, demonic forces, Satan's forces, God has given the kingship to Jesus, hasn't he? Isn't that what it's all about? Remember the Messiah is the Christ? It's like the authority has been given. So if the authority has been given to Jesus, then something that looks immovable, like a huge mountain, is not impossible simply because God has made the decree that Jesus is king. I think that's what that verse is doing in this context. So it's not like I as an individual can dream up anything I want, but it's like we together, when we confront stuff like demonic powers, we will see those things no longer having a hold on a person. We'll see Satan's grip falling because God has decreed the kingship is to be given to Jesus. Does that make sense in context?
That's where our prayers come into play.
Prayers, absolutely. Yeah. So much happens in prayer, doesn't it? Yeah. I hope your prayers are kind of like a conversation with God rather than just a shopping list. It's fine to ask God for things. And when you're in trouble, help is a brilliant prayer. That's fine. But ultimately, prayer isn't just, can I have this? Prayer is, what are you doing, God? And how can I participate with you in what you are doing? Because when you see what God's doing, when you hear what God's doing, it's not difficult to be aligned with God and to trust God for what he has decreed. So I think prayer is that, the place where we hear and then respond to God. Beautiful. So, nothing will be impossible. The kingship of Jesus will rule the whole earth. It's all easy from here. It's all downhill. Oh, no, it's not. They come back to Galilee and he says, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men and they will kill him. So it's not just like I can have whatever I like. There's suffering. There's a struggle because the hands of men want to strangle Jesus. Those who claim power of each other want to kill him. Now, I think it's important that we understand how God set the world up in the beginning. The way I read Genesis chapter 1, God said to humans, I have created you in my image, and I want you together to help me to reign over creation. I'm giving you dominion over all the creatures, the land creatures, the creepy crawlies, the birds, in the sea, all the different parts of creation. I'm giving you authority, dominion over all of creation to share my reign. But God never said, I want you to have power over each other. It was over all the rest of creation. So the kingdom of God established in Genesis 1 is humans ruling over God's creation on God's behalf and God ruling over humans. So we weren't designed to have power over each other. So when the Son of Man falls into the hands of men and they want to kill him, the world is out of order. This is not how God designed it to be in the first place. And humans will do their worst against Jesus. That's where the Gospel of Matthew is going. But God will still raise him to life, because when humans give death, God gives life. The disciples were filled with grief because all they could understand was that their model is Jesus. And that's very understandable. But they did not understand that this is how God was going to overturn the reign of evil and reestablish the reign of heaven on earth. Okay with that? Let's do one more before we break tonight. This is hilariously funny. I love this one. Perhaps we'll read it from the notes. Page 116, verses 24 and 25. Thank you, Liz.
Traveling back to Galilee, Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be handed over to the hands of men. They'll kill him, and on the third day he will be raised up." They were deeply grieved. When they reached Capernaum, the collectors of the temple tax approached Peter. "Your teacher pays the temple tax, doesn't he?" "Yes," Peter said.
I don't know. Every year, Peter had seen Jesus paying the tax, right? So, yeah, of course he does. There's no question in Peter's mind. Jesus is not making trouble. But something's changed since last year. This year, Peter has just announced that Jesus is the king. Does the king pay tax? That's the question that's being asked. Okay, we'll pick it up from verses 25b and 26.
When Peter went inside, Jesus raised the topic. "What do you think, Simon? From whom do earthly kings receive the taxes or contributions? From their own sons or from others?" "From others," Peter said. "Right," Jesus said, "so their sons are free."
So Jesus doesn't have to pay the tax at all because he's the king. And the king doesn't pay tax. People pay tax to the king. So if these temple tax collectors are trying to get tax out of Jesus, it's because they don't recognize him as the king. Up until this point, we have not seen Jesus claiming to be king because he doesn't claim power for himself. It has to be God-given, right? But now that Peter has recognized him as the Messiah, the Son who reigns on earth with his Father's authority, Jesus is beginning to discuss the fact that he's king. So this is probably the closest we have seen yet to Jesus making a kingship claim. He's able to confide in Peter because Peter has the revelation.
Well, I thought Jesus claiming himself to be king is not the king of the people, like, yeah, you know, the country or whatever. He's not claiming that. He's claiming to be king of people's hearts and from a religious point of view. I thought it was like two separate kingships. Yep. Is that right?
Yep. So what you're describing, Audrey, is how Christians have often thought about this. Like Martin Luther talked that way. There's the political kings, and then there's the spiritual king who's in charge of people's hearts, but not actually territory. I'm not convinced that's the right way for us to think about that. It's a common way to think about it, but I'm not convinced that's right. Because if you think back into Old Testament times, what kind of king was David? He was king of a territory, and the son of David, Solomon, and each of the sons of David until they were wiped out. And then when Jesus comes riding into Jerusalem, the promise from Zechariah is that the king will be back. And the crowd starts saying, "Blessed is the son of David who's coming in the name of the Lord," right? So I'm not convinced that we're meant to be thinking purely of our spiritual kingship. Maybe we need a bigger understanding of the nature of the world and the nature of the problem of the world. The world's in a mess because people have grasped power over other people that ultimately should be in God's hands. You can trace in the Old Testament story how that happens. A guy named Nimrod in chapter 10 of Genesis, in the list of the nations there, who's the first warrior. He's called a hunter, but he's not hunting animals. He's hunting people. He's realized that he can use war as a means to gain territory for himself. And Genesis 10 says that's how the big kingdoms that were enemies of Israel were formed, kingdoms that specifically names Assyria and Babylon. It's the big kingdoms that were problematic. So the actual kingdoms and the kingships of this world are in fact aligned against God and his regular authority. So in the end, God is going to have to bring down the proud rulers who become kings by conducting wars and killing people. God's going to have to raise up Jesus as the king who has all authority over the entire planet, over the whole land, the whole world, which belongs as a kingdom of heaven rather than the kingdoms of this world. So you're, by the time you get to the book of Revelation, you actually see the kingdom of this world has become the kingdom of our God. So it's not like there can't be any earthly representatives who are reigning in any countries, but they have to be sub-kings under Jesus. So he has to be physically king of the entire planet in the end. And that's the authority that's being given to Jesus, all authority in heaven and on earth over every part, every country, every nation, every people group. So his kingship is global, cosmic, rather than without territory, rather than just a spiritual thing, I would suspect. How does that sit?
Really think about
that. Great, excellent. That's the goal, of course. The goal is not that we all agree, but that we think about the authority that God is giving to Jesus and how far it extends and how every other power needs to come under his authority in the end.
Is it also linked to what you were sharing last week when Jesus said, I will build my church, is actually a political...
Yes,
that is a
totally.
Term.
Ecclesia was a political term and is a political term. And so we are the people who gather around the kingship of Jesus. Absolutely. Which is a wildly different way to think from how some of us grew up.
Say that he would build his church in that sense?
He will build his ecclesia. He will build the community of people who gather around his kingship. All right, so Jesus is making the point that because he is king, he really doesn't have to pay tax to the Romans or to the temple leaders, the two authorities that were present in Israel. He's free from that. But if he refuses to pay tax, he'll be killed as a rebel. That would be totally offensive to the temple and to Caesar. So as not to cause offense, Jesus says, why don't we give him some money anyway? Verse 27, thank you.
But we don't want to offend them, so head down to the lake and draw in a line. Open the mouth of the first fish you catch and you'll find a coin, enough to pay my tax and your...
What I find hilarious about this is that if Jesus is the rightful king of all creation, but he's not a taxing king. Remember from chapter 11 when Jesus said, my yoke is not a heavy yoke. It's not taxing like Solomon's son was, like Solomon was. I'm not that kind of a oppressive king on you. His kingship is the kingship of servanthood rather than domination. The creatures of the earth are under human kingship. So he says to Peter, let's get a creature to pay the tax for us. Sends him down to the lake. The fish cops up the tax. Peter heads off and pays the tax for himself and for Jesus so as not to cause offence, not because Jesus has to pay, he doesn't have to pay it, he's king, but so as not to cause offence, he just takes something from the creation in order to make peace. And I can imagine Peter laughing all the way to the lake to throw in, collect the tax from one of the creatures, because that would be a much better way for the kingship to work rather than to have a taxing king. So good. Such a clever solution for the dilemma. And so typical of Jesus, not making demands on anybody, being willing to sacrifice more than what he needed to give in order to make peace. There's some gospel in that. Well, that's it for chapter 7, eh? Why don't we take a break and come back right on 8 o'clock, because there's quite a lot of stuff in chapter 18 that I think we will want to discuss, so we'll leave ourselves some good time for that.